Imagine you're 14 years old and you're living in Los Angeles.
Okay.
And there is this phenomenal, completely free after-school robotics program. It's like just 1 mile from your front door.
Right, which sounds amazing.
It's exactly the kind of thing that could totally change the trajectory of your life, you know. But to actually get there from your neighborhood, you have to cross a massive 8-lane freeway.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's a barrier.
There's no pedestrian bridge, there's
Wow.
no safe bus route. So practically speaking, that life-changing program, I mean, it might as well be on the moon.
Yeah, and that's, well, it's a localized geographic failure, right? But it actually represents a much larger systemic problem.
How so?
Because we tend to look at a map of a major city and just sort of assume that because it's one continuous physical space, it must operate as one cohesive machine.
Right, like somebody's in charge of the whole board.
Exactly. We assume someone is looking at that teenager, looking at that freeway, and, coordinating a solution, but that's rarely the case.
And you are here with us on this deep dive because you're the kind of person who wants to understand how these massive systems actually work like beneath the surface and beyond those assumptions.
Because the reality of municipal government is, well, it's messy.
It is incredibly messy. So today we are looking at a really specific, totally fascinating blueprint. We're diving into excerpts from the LA Youth Outcomes Coordination
It was
Framework.
just quite a mouthful.
It really is. But basically, it's a prototype for a brand new civic operating model in the city of Los Angeles, and it's attempting to solve that exact freeway problem we just talked about.
Right. The mission here is to unpack a very delicate operation. We're looking at how a notoriously fragmented metropolis is trying to align its youth services, its schools, and its physical infrastructure.
But without like executing a hostile bureaucratic takeover, right?
Exactly. It's essentially the design of a completely new kind of civic machinery.
Okay, let's unpack this because right out of the gate, our source material highlights a massive structural dilemma. I mean, if you live in a big city, you probably just assume the mayor or the city council ultimately runs the local public schools.
Most people do assume that.
Right. But in Los Angeles, they absolutely do not. The city of LA and the Los Angeles Unified School District, they are legally distinct authorities.
And that is the root of so much administrative gridlock. You have a massive school district with, its own elected board, its own budget, its own massive bureaucracy.
Like a totally separate government.
Basically, yeah. And then you have the city with its distinct departments, its distinct budget, distinct elected officials.
But they're both trying to serve the exact same kids.
Yes, the exact same kids living in the exact same neighborhoods, but they operate completely independently of one another.
Honestly, it reminds me of like a broken corporate supply chain. Imagine a massive retail company where the manufacturing warehouse, the delivery drivers, and the retail storefronts, they all use completely incompatible software systems.
Oh, that's a great way to think about it.
And worse, none of them actually report to the same CEO. They're just sort of like hoping the product somehow gets to the customer.
That is a highly accurate analogy. And historically, when a city government looks at this kind of fragmentation, their first instinct is to try and consolidate power.
Right, like we're taking over.
Exactly. They try to take over the school district, or they mandate compliance through new laws. But this framework introduces a guiding mantra that shifts the entire paradigm.
What's the mantra?
The mandate here is to, quote, coordinate without pretending to control.
Coordinate without pretending to control. That's wild for a government agency to admit.
Right. It's very humble. And to achieve that, they built what the framework calls the Youth Outcomes Compact.
Okay, what is that exactly?
So instead of a legal mandate, it relies on a system of non-binding public commitments, a shared inventory services, and a quarterly public reporting. And a big part of it is that everyone involved has to stay strictly in their own lane.
Let's actually look at who those players are, because I don't want to get lost in all the bureaucratic alphabet soup.
Good call. Let's focus on their functions. First, you have the city's dedicated youth development department.
Yeah.
Their lane is basically setting the overall standards, managing the data, and running the public dashboard. They're the record keepers.
But they don't actually teach the kids.
No, not at all. The school district retains total sovereign governance over classroom instruction and, school facility.
Right. They own the schools. Okay, so who else?
Then you bring in the county level education office. They handle coordination for highly vulnerable populations like youth in the juvenile justice system or foster care.
Got it.
Add to that, the city department's responsible for workforce pathways. So the people actually trying to get older teenagers into jobs and internships.
Okay, and we can't forget the actual physical spaces, right?
Yeah.
The city's Parks and Recreation Department, along with the public library system, they act as the physical hubs. Like, they actually have the real estate.
Exactly. And finally, you have the community-based organizations.
The local nonprofits.
Right. They're the ones actually delivering the culturally competent on-the-ground services to the families.
Okay. But I have to play devil's advocate here for a second. You have, like, half a dozen massive, fiercely independent bureaucracies.
Very fiercely independent.
Right. They're highly protective of their autonomy and their budgets. And this framework is asking them to sign a non-binding public commitment.
Yes.
In the world of government, isn't a non-binding commitment just a really polite, well-documented way of saying no one is actually forced to do anything?
I mean, it seems incredibly weak on paper, I'll give you that. But practically speaking, not taking over is actually the framework's greatest strength.
Really? No.
Think about the alternative. If the city tried to legally force the school district or the county to comply with a centralized directive, they would be tied up in litigation for a decade.
Well, lawyers suing lawyers.
Exactly.
Aye.
By explicitly remaining non-binding, they completely bypass years of legal turf wars.
Okay, I see that. But then they're replacing legal coercion with what? Just hoping people play nice?
They are replacing it with radical transparency. They're allowing these distinct entities to voluntarily plug into the same outcome loop.
Outcome loop.
Yeah. Basically, you don't have to report to the same boss, but you do have to put your data on the exact same public scoreboard.
Okay. But to build a scoreboard, you have to actually, like, map the playing field first.
Precisely.
Which brings us to how they locate the actual problems.
Yeah.
Because you can't fix a surface gap if you literally don't know where it is geographically. So the framework outlines this spatial diagnosis using a geographic information system, or GIS.
And this is where we get back to that 14-year-old trying to cross the freeway. The GIS map isn't just, you know, plotting the locations of schools and libraries on a street map.
Right. It's way more advanced than that.
It layers incredibly complex realities on top of one another. So it maps youth need indices like where are the highest concentrations of poverty or disconnected youth.
Up.
It maps city programs. But crucially, it maps transit lines and what they call safe route gaps.
And that is the layer that changes everything, I think. Because a youth hub is only as good as a family's actual ability to safely navigate to it.
Exactly. If you can't walk there safely, it doesn't matter if it's open.
Uh-huh.
So to evaluate these neighborhoods, the framework measures readiness across six specific dimensions.
Okay, what are they?
First is need clarity. Do we actually have granular data on what the youth in the specific zip code are asking for?
Like maybe they want arts programs, not sports.
Right. Second is program inventory, what is already operating there. Third is facility capacity. Are the local buildings structurally sound and are they even available?
Makes sense. What's the fourth?
Fourth is data sharing. Are the local agencies actually willing to talk to each other?
That's a big one.
Huge. Fifth is youth voice. Are young people actively involved in the design process? And sixth is the capital path.
Capital path meaning, like, is there actual money available to build or retrofit something?
Exactly. Is there funding? Now, to manage those six dimensions, the framework introduces this software layer. It's essentially a routing engine to process all this data, and it operates in six sequential steps.
Walk me through the steps, because this sounds like where the magic actually happens.
It really is. So right. Step one is research intake. This is where all that geographic and demographic data is loaded into the system. Step two is stakeholder feedback.
Where they ask the community.
Right. The system ingests advisory input directly from youth councils and families in that specific neighborhood.
Okay, so step three is decision routing. That's where the software analyzes the data and actually flags the specific gaps. Right?
Exactly. And then step four is the community feed. This is vital. It automatically publishes unresolved blockers and notes for the public to see.
So everyone can see what's stuck.
Yes. Step five is a refinement loop that rescores the neighborhood gaps based on any new data. And finally, step six generates a deployment package.
Okay, let's pause on that deployment package. What exactly is that?
The deployment package is the ultimate output of the whole diagnostic process. The software essentially spits out a neighborhood-specific packet that says, here is a map of the service desert, here is the estimated cost to fix it, and here are the explicit owners responsible for making it happen.
I'm going to look at this from the perspective of a resident for a second, because if you live in any major city, you've probably seen like a mayor or a council member stand at a podium and unveil this gorgeous, highly interactive digital dashboard.
Oh, absolutely. With the heat maps and the charts.
Right. It looked like the bridge of the Starship Enterprise.
Yeah.
And then a year later, absolutely nothing has changed on your block. The dashboard is just, you know, a PR exercise.
A very expensive PR exercise.
Exactly. So how does this specific routing engine prevent this incredible spatial data from just sitting in the digital filing cabinet?
The difference here is between a passive system and an active workflow engine. Most civic dashboards are purely passive. They're just designed to show you how bad a problem is.
Like, look, there's no parks here.
Right. They display the poverty rate or the lack of park space, and then they just stop. But this software layer is active. By exporting that final deployment package, the software actually forces bureaucratic accountability.
Because it literally attaches a name and a deadline to the heat map.
Precisely. It doesn't just say, this neighborhood lacks after-school programs. It says, this neighborhood lacks programs, the solution costs exactly this much, and the Parks Department is the designated agency responsible for opening a facility by next quarter.
Wow. So it weaponizes the transparency we talked about earlier.
It totally weaponizes it.
Okay, so the software generates this neat little deployment package with a name on it. But pointing at a problem on a map doesn't actually unlock the doors to a new youth center.
No, it doesn't.
So who actually holds the keys? If the software says go, who has the legal authority to actually press the button?
And this brings us to the most dangerous phase of any civic project, the transfer of power.
The black hole of government.
Exactly where well-intentioned initiatives usually go to die. To solve this, the framework utilizes a decision authority matrix. It basically takes the concept of power and categorizes it into four distinct lanes.
Okay, lay them out for me. First lane.
First, you have the advisory lane. This is where the youth councils and the local family sit. They provide non-binding signals and recommendations.
So they basically point the compass. They say, hey, we need mental health services here, not just another basketball court.
Exactly. The second lane is operational. This is the city's youth department and the various service agencies. They handle the mechanics.
Like the day-to-day stuff.
Right. They figure out the referral pathways, the staffing models, the daily calendars. They design the actual service path.
Got it. What's the third lane?
The third lane is the heavyweight budget and capital.
The money.
The money, the mayor, the city council, the school board, the county supervisors, they hold the purse strings, they handle the actual dollars, they sign the memorandums of understanding, and they approve massive capital construction projects.
Okay, and the fourth lane?
The fourth lane is compliance and equity.
The lawyers.
The lawyers. This lane is occupied by the city attorney, the school district's legal counsel, privacy officers. They manage all the legal tripwires.
Like what kind of tripwires?
Well, they ensure compliance with open meeting laws, like the Brown Act. They manage ADA accessibility requirements. They handle FERPA, which governs the strict privacy of student educational records.
It honestly functions exactly like a traffic light system for city government. Think about it. The advisory lane suggests the destination.
Yeah.
The operational lane builds the car. The budget lane buys the gas. And the compliance lane makes sure nobody gets run over, legally speaking, along the way.
That is a brilliant way to phrase it. And it's a phenomenal mechanism for isolating failure points.
Because normally everyone just blames everyone else, right?
Always. In a standard bureaucracy, when a project stalls out, the instinct is to pass the buck. The community asks why the youth center isn't open, and the school district points a finger at the city council, saying they didn't provide funding.
And then the city council blames the lawyers, saying they wouldn't approve the liability waiver.
Exactly. It's an endless circle. But with this matrix, if a deployment package stalls, the dashboard instantly reveals the bottleneck.
Oh, that's clever.
Right. If the matrix shows the operational plan is finished and the budget is fully approved but the project hasn't launched, everyone instantly knows it's stuck in the compliance lane.
The lawyer is the one holding it up.
Yes. It forces the specific blocker into the sunlight.
Okay, so we have the coordination compact, we have the spatial software routing the data, and we have this matrix isolating who is responsible.
Right.
But let's ground this in reality for a second. How does all this elaborate abstract coordination actually change the physical environment of a neighborhood? Like, what does a family actually see happening on their street?
That's the most important question. The framework answers that by translating coordination into a three-tier physical infrastructure plan. It essentially breaks the deployment down by time, turning abstract agreements into tangible places.
Okay, so tier one, that's the 0 to 12 month window, right? The framework calls this quick build service access.
Right. And we are not talking about construction here.
We're talking about using what's already there.
Mm.
Co-locating youth navigators in places that already exist, like a local library branch or a park building.
Yes. Or opening up joint use schoolyards so kids can actually play basketball after 4 p.m. instead of facing a locked gate.
And launching mobile service days in those designated service deserts.
Exactly. Now, Tier 2 expands to a 1 to 3 year horizon. This is the retrofitting phase.
Retrofitting?
Yeah, the city takes underused public rooms and converts them into dedicated youth labs. They might add necessary shade structures, better lighting, secure access, Wi-Fi.
Upgrading the existing spaces.
Right. This is also when they start building those physical safe route links we talked about, putting in the crosswalks and transit stops to literally connect schools to parks.
Okay, and then Tier 3 is the 3 to 7 year plan. This is the permanent infrastructure.
Mm.
The city builds or acquires brand new permanent youth and civic campuses in areas with the highest need.
Massive facilities.
Right, these places bundle education, workforce training, wellness centers, and family navigation all under one roof. And I want to push back on this timeline a bit.
Go for it.
7 years. If I'm a parent listening to a city official tell me they have a 7-year plan for a new youth center, I am immediately tuning out.
Oh, for sure.
Right. In 7 years, my middle schooler is going to be in college or out in workforce. To a family, 7 years just sounds like standard bureaucratic delay.
It is an incredibly long time in the lifespan of a child. And historically, cities have made the catastrophic mistake of only focusing on Tier 3.
They just promise the shiny new building.
Exactly. They promise a massive state-of-the-art facility. But to actually build it, they have to wrangle bond capital, conduct environmental reviews, negotiate joint development deals.
It takes forever.
It takes a decade. And families wait. And a whole generation of kids ages out of the system with absolutely no support.
Which is why Tier 1 is so crucial to the actual survival of this framework.
It is the only way to build public trust. You simply cannot ask a community to wait 7 years for a building if you aren't doing anything for them today.
Right.
So by focusing heavily on quick builds, by simply unlocking a schoolyard gate on a Saturday, or bringing a mobile mental health clinic to a local park for a weekend, the city creates immediate, visible momentum.
You show the community that the machine is actually capable of moving.
Yes. You secure the political and public goodwill necessary to keep the whole system alive while those 7-year capital projects slowly make their way through the pipeline.
It's basically proof of concept, but, you know, a blueprint is totally useless until you actually try to build the house.
Absolutely.
So to wrap up our analysis, we really need to look at how this prototype is being tested in the real world. The framework outlines a 90-day pilot, but they aren't just rolling it out uniformly across all of Los Angeles.
No, they're being very strategic. They are stress testing it in 3 highly distinct geographies.
Why those 3?
Because each one presents a fundamentally different logistical challenge. They need to test the framework's ability to adapt.
Okay, so the first geography is South LA. And according to the framework's metrics, this area has the highest youth need score in the pilot. It's sitting at a 92.
Which is incredibly high on their scale.
Right. But the primary challenge there isn't just a lack of general programs. It's a critical need for workforce access.
Yes.
The area has an access gap of 44. And the pilot's explicit target is to hit an 82% access rate for workforce pathways.
South LA is very dense. And the need for older teenagers to find viable employment and internship pipelines there is just acute. So it's a test of whether the coordination layer can effectively link high schools to actual city employers.
Okay, but then you look at the second geography, which is the Northeast and East Side. The overall youth need score is lower, at 74.
Still high, but lower than South LA.
Right. But the problem here is deeply structural in a different way. The focus in the Northeast is on school, transit, and park access coordination.
Yes, moving kids safely.
Exactly. They have an access gap of 31 and a target of 84%. It's all about moving kids through the neighborhood safely.
And then you move to the third pilot area, which is the Valley Corridor. The need score drops to 66 there. But the valley presents an entirely different set of environmental and geographic barriers.
Because it's huge.
It is incredibly spread out. You are dealing with vast distances between services. Furthermore, you are dealing with extreme climate issues.
That is such a fascinating point to me. Because when it's 105 degrees in August in the San Fernando Valley, asking a teenager to walk a mile to a bus stop, wait 20 minutes without any shade, and take two different buses to get to a job training center, that is an active barrier to entry.
The climate itself dictates the service gap.
Exactly. Their access gap there is 49, with a target of 78%. It's such an excellent way to visualize the pilot. It's basically like stress testing a new app on three completely different operating systems.
I love that analogy. South LA tests the system's ability to handle high-density workforce demands. The Northeast tests its ability to solve transit and spatial fragmentation. And the Valley tests its ability to overcome raw distance and environmental hostility.
And notice the precision of those targets, too. Like hitting an 82% access rate in South LA, hitting 78% in the Valley. If they reach the end of the 90-day pilot, and they have only hit, say, 60% in South LA, the system doesn't just shrug its shoulders.
No, it doesn't.
That refinement loop we talked about in the software layer, it automatically kicks in. It forces the local agencies back to the table using that public dashboard to explain why the needle didn't move.
The mechanism is literally designed for relentless visible iteration.
So stepping back to look at the big picture here, what does all of this actually mean for how we govern? I mean, even if you have never set foot in Los Angeles, this deep dive reveals a highly modern blueprint for solving systemic gridlock anywhere.
It really does.
It proves that to fix a broken, fragmented system, you do not always need to consolidate power. You don't always have to engage in some hostile legal takeover or tear down existing institutions. Sometimes the solution is building a radically transparent, highly structured coordination layer that just sort of sits lightly on top of all the chaos.
It relies entirely on the premise that you can coordinate without controlling. But, you know, as we look at this framework, it does leave us with a lingering fundamental tension to consider.
What's that?
The entire model assumes that sunlight is the best disinfectant.
It relies on the shame of the public dashboard.
Yes. Right. But what happens when the data clearly shows that one specific, incredibly powerful agency is continually failing to meet its public commitments?
Oh, man.
Right. In a system built purely on non-binding compacts where nobody can legally fire or fine the offending department, we have to ask a really difficult question.
Which is?
Is the pressure of public transparency actually enough to force a massive, entrenched bureaucracy to change its behavior? Or over time, will those agencies simply learn to ignore the dashboard?
Wow. It's the ultimate test of accountability. Can embarrassment actually move mountains?
We'll see.
It is a fascinating question to mull over as you observe the civic machinery running your own city. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive, and as always, keep questioning the systems around you.